Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith.
Who was the chosen one to run Afghanistan? Going back to the 1970s, it was always Gulbuddin Hekmatyar.
Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald provide their expert analysis on Afghanistan and Pakistan. They're authors of the book Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story. The name of their new book will have special meaning, according to Paul Fitzgerald.
Crossing Zero. The line between Pakistan and Afghanistan is known by the defense establishment and the intelligence community as Zero Line.
The lessons in history Gould and Fitzgerald bring us offer a grim warning about trying to cross Zero and dominate both Pakistan and Afghanistan by military force. Others have tried and failed and lost national fortunes doing so. We contacted Gould and Fitzgerald after receiving an urgent message from journalist Muhammad Khurshid, who is in the Bajor Agency tribal areas on the Pakistan side of the border. It's been a week of terror in Peshawar, civilians now scrambling to find safety, as the government of Prime Minister Yousaf Raza Gilani seems disinterested in protecting civilians.
Pakistan is the frontline state in the war on terrorism, but at the moment the administration is collapsed completely. As now the terrorists are free to carry out attacks anywhere if they want. In the morning, they have carried out an attack on a school in which two small students were killed and several others were injured. Two attacks were carried out in Kuwait in which more than 20 people were killed. One of the journalists were also killed in that blast.
April has been a month of terror in Pakistan, and there are indications here and there of political undertones beneath the chaos. At the start of April, the UN issued a damning report about Pakistan's internal investigation of the assassination of former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. On April 4th, a car bomb went off at the U.S. consulate in Peshawar. Muhammad Khurshid explains that civilians are trapped as warlords, Taliban leaders, Al-Qaeda members, and political hopefuls tussle for power. The U.S. government trying to find partners in a region where partnership brings heavy risk.
The main reason of the war in this region is the U.S. They have been carrying out the drone attacks. They have been carrying out attacks in other parts of the country. So the rest and retaliation are targeting the innocent people. But still, the U.S. is supporting the corrupt leadership, and they are not supporting the sincere leader who come forward and save this region and save Pakistan from further death and destruction. Till now, the Taliban is claiming that they have been carrying out the attacks. The leadership of the Taliban is hiding. The army is also carrying out the operation. The local police is also carrying out the operation. But still, these people are free to carry out the attacks and kill the innocent people. There is completely anarchy and no one is knowing what is happening and everyone is running for his life. And it's a very bad situation.
We turn now to Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould, very familiar with this area, yet surprised to hear from an attorney saying he represented the notorious warlord Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. Their story about the encounter in Huffington Post.
We put out a post on the prospect that Gulbuddin Hekmatyar was being brought into the government, or might be brought into the government, of Hamid Karzai. And there have been a number of reports over the last few years that negotiations were in the works with Richard Holbrook over bringing him into the government and somehow bringing the Taliban and bringing other former warlords. As your audience probably knows, that the government of Hamid Karzai was originally staffed with warlords by the Bush administration.
In fact, originally at the Bonn conference, when there was an attempt to initiate the first new government after the Taliban had been driven out of Afghanistan, the Loya Jirga that took place really wanted to bring the king back as a very significant force for reuniting the country. And the Bush administration completely nixed that idea, and Hamid Karzai was literally lifted up and became the one that the Afghans pretty much had to accept. And he came along with a lot of warlords as a part of that package. So the idea of warlords and this is where the whole issue of Gulbuddin comes up. Gulbuddin really is the poster warlord. You know, he's the one that goes back to 1973 that was working with the Pakistanis, that was a part of the insurgency way back at starting in 1973 to destabilize the government back then. So, you know, you're looking at a very, very, you know, long history of problems, you know, in terms of the way Hekmatyar has been used, certainly by the United States, he was used by the Pakistanis, and he certainly doesn't seem to very well represent the interests of the Afghan people.
We did a blog about the possibility of him being brought back, and we recited some of the things that are well known about him. Everybody who's had any kind of experience in Afghanistan over the last 30 years knows full well about this guy as a terrorist, and the fact is that he was labeled a terrorist by the State Department as well as by the Treasury Department, and so in the United States. So he therefore is officially labeled as a terrorist. He has been firing upon, and his troops have been firing upon NATO and American forces. When you have that designation, you can't have an organization that operates in the United States, certainly. So we got an email from his representative telling us that we were risking legal action for saying horrible things about his boss, the wonderful His Excellency Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. Now, this is absolutely unbelievable. And the fact is, what's even more unbelievable is that the man who represents Gulbuddin Hekmatyar lives in Los Angeles and operates freely. He's been quoted in a number of different articles over the last couple of years as having negotiations with Holbrooke.
Richard Holbrooke, U.S. Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan.
So, I mean, here's a situation where you have a man, you know, imagine if Adolf Hitler were out there on the run someplace, but he had his Nazi party was operating in the United States and had a representative in Los Angeles who defended him in the public arena. I mean, it's aside from being absurd, this is the kind of thing that was going on before 9/11. I mean, the United States had a lot of associations with people that were completely disreputable, that were tearing down their own governments in many cases, that were breaking apart governments and nations in other parts of the world, but they seem to somehow elude detection when it comes to the American policymakers. So this is where we are right now, and where do we go from here?
And of course, one of the problems getting information out of this part of the world, journalists now under threat. We heard from journalist Mohammed Khurshid recently that journalists were being killed.
You may know that the suicide attack was also carried out on the press club in Peshawar. So at the moment, doing journalism is a very uphill task for the journalists. Most of the journalists are just keeping low profile because there is a lot of threats and the threats are from both sides. The government is also terrorizing the journalists, and the terrorist is also after the journalists. So it's now doing journalism is a very difficult job. The main cause of this fighting is dollars. If the U.S. stop the dollar, I think there will be no war.
And listeners can hear all of the interview with Mohammed Khurshid at our website, talknationradio.org. So this border region under threat, people fleeing, warlords seeing the opportunity and moving in, trying to either dominate the governments of Afghanistan or Pakistan or move into positions of power themselves. And that is what it sounds like Gulbuddin Hekmatyar is trying to do, right?
Well, there's actually a very interesting, complex situation that's also being played, which is the idea of the Taliban actually is being used as a buffer against the warlordism. So here you have the Taliban, whose reputation was sealed in the 1990s for having created what at the time was referred to as gender apartheid, who were, you know, revealed finally as having effectively enslaved Afghan women and any man that supported the Afghan women. And now we have this constant effort to try to reframe and reform the image of the Taliban, along with Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who is certainly much more of the classic warlord. Okay, he is not considered this in the same league, I think, in the sense of the Taliban coming out of the religious madrasas of very much the refugee, Pakistani refugee camps. He did not have that particular history. But the idea that they all claim the mantle of the proper kind of Islam and they're all going to convert Afghanistan, and certainly this was done by the Taliban back in the 1990s. So now we're looking at a situation where the Taliban now are actually trying to be sold effectively as a better alternative to the warlords, which in itself is just another sham.
You have to look back to the 1990s and look at the entire situation and realize that both the warlords and the Taliban were the creations of the United States, Britain, and Pakistan's foreign policy and intelligence services. So what's happening right now is it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy, and it's perpetuating itself. So you have to ask yourself, what really is the goal of this policy? The United States has been playing what they refer to as cowboys and Indians in the Hindu Kush since 2001. As we all know at this point, it was suspected at the time, but we know at this point that after a very short period of time, the U.S. pretty much packed up and left for Iraq and then devoted all of its men and material and firepower to overthrowing Saddam Hussein, where, of course, Al-Qaeda was not, which was not an imminent threat, and which they completely misjudged the situation. You know, somebody said at the time, General Odom, who had been the deputy to Zbigniew Brzezinski back in the Carter administration, was very pessimistic about what was going on in Iraq early on. Within a year or two, he mentioned the fact that the word was out that Iraq was America's Stalingrad. In other words, we were pouring in materiel, soldiers, an enormous amount of money for a very illogical purpose, and our gain wasn't succeeding. The American people, we seem to be on this merry-go-round of warfare that doesn't get us anywhere. The big fear was that Iraq and Afghanistan would become new Vietnams, and they have become new Vietnams, except even worse. But the fact is that we, the American people, I mean, we up in Massachusetts where we live, I mean, we just had the election of Scott Brown as an example. It was a shock to everyone nationally that this very conservative Republican should take the seat of Ted Kennedy in the Senate, the archetype liberal since the 1970s here. But the fact is that we seem to be bouncing back and forth between one bad idea and another bad idea. And now the Republicans, of course, the conservatives are coming forward again and saying, oh, these Democrats can't solve the problem. We're going to solve the problem. Well, you know, it's been created by the same thought process over and over again, and we have to get off the carousel.
If you look at the history of who was the chosen one to run Afghanistan, going back to the 1970s, it was always Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. It was in the early 1990s when Hekmatyar was set up to try and take over Afghanistan after the Soviet withdrawal and the Civil War, which that was really a warlord war. And the Afghan population were actually being brutalized by the war between the warlords who were trying to see who would take over. When Gulbuddin was not going to take over, that was when the idea of the Taliban emerged from the Pakistani intelligence in order to ensure that if it wasn't Gulbuddin, it was going to be Pakistani-friendly, and that was always the goal. So what we're looking at now is a continuation, really, of a very single-minded policy to ultimately have Afghanistan controlled by a Pakistani-friendly government.
Polls indicate that only something like 6% of the Afghan population wants the Taliban back in any kind of control of the government. It's one thing when these members in the early 1990s and mid-1990s were recruited to get rid of the warlords, but the population in general wants both the warlords and the Taliban disarmed and brought back into the government. And NATO and the United States have not been able to offer that option to the Afghan people. And one of the reasons they haven't been able to do that, they haven't been able to defeat the Taliban, is one, Pakistan's complicity in supporting the Taliban, and two, the fact is that the United States and NATO went and restocked Afghanistan with warlords that had fought against the Soviets back in the 1980s, or their inheritors, like the Haqqani Network is an example. They were the prime beneficiaries, along with Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, the Haqqanis were, of the American largesse back in the 1980s. So this is a situation where the United States had a misguided policy back in the 1980s and then couldn't succeed in fulfilling whatever it wanted to do with that misguided policy once the Soviets left. Pakistanis picked it up, and with foreign support from the Middle East, have now turned it into almost a fait accompli. This is a conservative revolution going on that was not what the people of Afghanistan wanted or what the people of Pakistan want. But power has been delivered into the hands of these people, and it's not exactly what you'd call democracy when you put a gun to somebody's head and say, pull the lever for my candidate.
The Obama administration made people hopeful that wars in the Mideast would end, and then brought the same team the Bush administration had in place in the Middle East into the Obama war effort. So one has to wonder if American voters really understand what they're seeing right now and who, in fact, is responsible for it.
The irony of the Obama administration and the Bush administration is that the Obama administration is pursuing the Bush administration policy, except they're only doing it more so. You know, George Bush was incompetent at even making it look good. Obama is very competent at making it look good, but it's still the same policy.
And it's still delivering the same results, which really is that the Afghan people and their longings to really have a genuine representation in a government has not been fulfilled. So again, in the idea of is this democracy? Absolutely not. This is not democracy according to the fundamentals of the Afghan people being allowed to elect their own officials based on their own preferences, which goes back to the Bonn Conference where the original choice of the king was rejected by the Bush administration.
Who is responsible for empowering warlords in this part of the world?
The foreign policy establishment of the United States that keeps producing this kind of approach to the rest of the world, I mean, really comes out of World War II. There was a huge debate going on during World War II between the progressives and the left in the United States and the militarists and the conservatives, the so-called military-industrial complex. I mean, it was serious enough, as we know, that President Eisenhower, in his last address, warned of the consequences of what would happen. Well, now we have the consequences of what has happened. We have an entire economy, an entire political consciousness that has been moved into a kind of war-gaining, constant, perpetual warfare mode, almost so to the point where the American public opinion has been pushed so far into this mentality that we don't even know that there's anything else. The professor at one of the universities here said, up until World War II, the United States had a very, very strong anti-war movement. There was this isolationist movement. There was an attitude that we really shouldn't be involved in European wars, that wars around the world had been started by greed and avarice and the bad application of power, that the United States had a very, very open democratic society that had produced an entirely different way of going about doing things, that warfare wasn't required. Well, you know, since World War II, he says, we're known around the world now for the exact opposite, that we are what we used to preach against. The consequences of this is that the rest of the world has now found other means by which to resolve their differences in a true kind of United Nations status, and we're the ones who are now being looked upon and threatened with a kind of containment policy.
When we got the note from Hekmatyar's representative in the United States, it was as if the terror that's going on in Afghanistan in a very horrific way has been delivered here. When someone like that can send a note with impunity to journalists who are reporting basically what has been reported by thousands of other journalists about Hekmatyar and be threatened, and there is no recourse against this.
What do you think that both Gulbuddin Hekmatyar and this attorney want you to believe that they would do?
He said, we were making ourselves very vulnerable. We're opening ourselves up to legal action. You know, the whole idea that we would somehow be open just for doing what American journalists do in our country, you know, is bad enough. I mean, it's bad enough when an American journalist is sued for putting out a story in the United States by somebody else in the United States. But when you've got a warlord from a place where the United States is conducting a war against that kind of thing to bring an open democracy.
He may very well have sent this note to many other journalists. We really don't know. But we do know that he is well known, at least Hekmatyar and his organization, for absolutely scaring many people into talking publicly about what has happened. There are many people who have been claimed to have been assassinated by Gulbuddin over the history going back to 73, going into the 1980s, individuals who were assassinated who were trying to bring some kind of resolution, peaceful resolution, to the Afghan crisis. So we can see that there is definitely a history of intimidation.
I don't think that this person would have expressed his views so clearly and openly if he didn't have some kind of tacit support from the United States. He is confident that he's not going to be taken off to Guantanamo and tortured for information on the whereabouts of Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. So this is what's so disturbing about it, is the fact that this man doesn't feel any, you know, inhibition about issuing threats from the United States to Americans about talking about the Afghan situation.
And have both of you been in touch with the U.S. State Department or other agencies?
In regard to this particular issue?
Yes.
No, we did not contact them.
But we know that this individual has been in contact with Holbrooke's office directly, has been in communication. We know at the highest levels they're well aware of this man.
And so, Elizabeth Gould, Paul Fitzgerald, does the new book pick up where you left off with Invisible History, The Untold Story of Afghanistan?
Our original book was intended to just give people the background on what the situation is vis-a-vis the United States and Afghanistan, and the West versus Afghanistan. The United States has had a long history of supporting these kinds of groups around the world. What's going on right now with Hamid Karzai is an example. He's the modern Manuel Noriega, he's the modern Pinochet, he's the modern Diem. The comparisons towards Vietnam are really quite striking. This is the way the United States does its business, and these are the consequences. When it works for the United States, they get a supportive dictator. When it doesn't work for the United States, they get quagmire. So what we have in Afghanistan is quagmire, and the United States is now quite willing, with the experience of Vietnam under its belt, quite willing to make negotiations with anybody and everybody it can possibly do in order to try to get itself out of this trap that it's manufactured for itself. The first book, of course, was to try to establish for the American public what the background and the context of our involvement there was. The new book, which will be coming out probably around January or February of next year, will deal specifically with the Obama administration and what they are doing, the kind of thing that we have just been talking about, the experience with Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, the experience with the Taliban, the negotiations that are taking place, the people that are involved. It'll be kind of a scorecard for the Obama administration for what it means to wage war in this part of the world, which, by the way, isn't just about the Taliban and Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. It's also about Iran. It's also about China. It's about Russia. It's about India and the future of America's relationship with some of the emerging powers of the world.
Any thoughts as to what you might title the next book?
Yes, we do have a title for the next book, Crossing Zero. The line between Pakistan and Afghanistan is known by the defense establishment and the intelligence community as Zero Line.
Are we more at risk personally as Americans during this Afghan war than we were even during the Vietnam War, let's say, and especially economically?
Yeah. Absolutely.
The big threat, of course, back in the 1960s was the so-called domino effect, that if the United States allowed Vietnam to fall into communist hands, that all of Southeast Asia would fall into communist hands. The fact is that didn't happen. But this is a very, very different scenario. In fact, the opposite is true.
Right now, the concern is that it's going to turn radically Islamist. It's still a competition, though, for the region. Russia and China really are both very vulnerable to the spread of radical Islam. And that is still a part of what was a part of the original radicalizing the Islamists out of Pakistan. Part of it was to get into the Soviet Union and disrupt the Islamic State. That's still a part of the scenario today. You have Xinjiang province in China that's very vulnerable to radical Islam. This is where the training took place, where Gulbuddin Hekmatyar and the Mujahideen were being trained. During the 1980s, the Chinese were very involved supporting that. Now they're paying a price for their involvement in another way.
And of course, you just had the recent bombing in Moscow, in the Moscow subway system. So these were Chechenians who were responsible for that. The Chechenians are being supported by the Taliban and by the radical extremist elements in South Central Asia. So this is an enormous problem, especially considering the fact that both China and India at this point are becoming economic powerhouses. The transfer of wealth from North America and even Europe to Central and South Asia and the Middle East at this point is just astonishing. It's historical. And that, needless to say, is another issue that has not been dealt with by our political class in the United States. Everyone seems to be going along. The amount of money that's being borrowed, as an example, the policies that are being put forward, which were designed during the middle of World War II and promoted throughout the Cold War in order to define America's relationship with the rest of the world, we have never gone back to reconsidering whether the right direction was taken following World War II in terms of the way in which the United States interfaced with the rest of the world. So now we're getting the results of this, and it looks like a train wreck in slow motion.
And then, of course, there's the large transfer of military industry jobs overseas to Israel and other countries.
We've been accused by Europeans of being extremely short-sighted in terms of the way we invest our money. And we're talking about American corporations, that the American corporation is focused on the next quarter's profit, and that There's no long-term planning. The engineering is done offshore. It's done someplace else. If somebody really wanted to go to war with us at this point and basically deprive the United States of what it needs to survive in the world, the United States is so reliant, and I mean American corporations are so reliant on their partners overseas at this point, we would be in very, very difficult shape if the world decided it wanted to gang up against us. And the fact is that, you know, strategic thinkers think about this thing. I would recommend that your audience read Known Unknowns. It's a military publication for wide distribution, put out about a year ago by a military thinker who said, all we can deal with in the world is essentially the known unknowns, those unknown unknowns, like events like 9/11 or what happened to the U.S. military when it got into Iraq. It said, can't be anticipated. They hypothesize and they say, in the future, what may happen is that China and Russia and all and these foreign powers who actually have the resources that we need to survive and have the technology at this point on an equal basis with the United States may just simply say, let's formulate a containment policy for the United States. The United States has been containing us. Let's all get together and contain the aggression of the United States. Our military establishment took the position, and our political establishment was convinced by our military establishment to take the position that shock and awe, as we recall the phrase from the early Bush administration, would be enough to cow our enemies into giving us what we wanted and what we needed for American interests. Iraq proved that that was not the case, that instead of shock and awe, what we got was death by a thousand cuts, and that's what's going on right now, and we're just at the beginning of seeing the consequences of that. I mean, our economic structure is very fragile. The reforms that have been proposed for the banking industry and the economy, as an example, are only band-aid over the underlying weaknesses in the structure of the system. And these all go back to policymakers that are just keeping the same policy going from generation to generation, regardless of who gets into the White House.
The United States was a creditor nation throughout the Reagan administration. That's when we began to transform into what now we're not even able to pay any of the principal against what we owe. We are only trying to pay interest. The level of debt is so phenomenal. So how long can this go on? And this process has been a transformation. I think the average American clearly is unaware of the real impact of this.
We have to remember as well, historically, that Afghanistan had a transformative effect on the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was forged during World War II and proved that it could beat the most advanced military power, Germany. Afghanistan is giving the United States the same lesson, and we are definitely trying to figure out how to get out of that in terms of Washington's position. But, you know, from our own impressions, when we go down to Washington, we talk to people, we discover that Washington bureaucrats tend to talk to Washington bureaucrats. They are almost immune to outside influences. The so-called beltway think tanks, the universities and institutions that funnel their talent into those places, unfortunately, our best and our brightest, it's like a crop. It's a monoculture. And when that monoculture hits upon a crisis, it's outside its paradigm. It's beyond its concept of capabilities. Then it has no defense whatsoever. And that's feeling more and more like what's going on in this country right now.
Thank you both again for joining us.
Well, thank you, Dory. It's always a pleasure.
InvisibleHistory.com is their website. The husband and wife writer-producer team of Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould have worked for CBS News. In 1981, they produced the documentary Afghanistan Between Three Worlds for PBS. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dory Smith. This program produced in Storrs, Connecticut, were syndicated with Pacifica Network. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, TalkNationRadio@gmail.com if you'd like to comment. Our music is by Fritz Heed.